You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest has news and advice to share as the next farmer's market season gets underway this spring.
First, in the immediate aftermath of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death in February, a political battle was launched. President Barack Obama said he would nominate a replacement, while Republican leaders in the Senate said that the task should be left to the winner of the presidential election in November.
The spring 2016 Wisconsin survey raised the issue of a replacement for Justice Scalia. 54% of respondents said the Senate should hold hearings and should vote on President Obama's appointee, Merrick Garland. 40% said the Senate should wait until after the election and hold hearings and vote on the new president's appointee. 6% unsure.
Thomas Crocker joins us now. He's the distinguished professor of law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He wrote an article for The Atlantic called "What Would Scalia Do?" Professor Crocker, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with that question. What would Antonin Scalia do if he were calling the shots on this?
He would hold hearings.
He would hold hearings. Why?
Because there is, if you looked at constitutional text and the history, there's no precedent for not holding hearings, and there's strong textual support for holding hearings, because Article 2 provides that the president shall nominate and, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint judges of the Supreme Court. So there's two imperatives there, that both the president and Congress act in their appropriate roles here.
And you've said that the language of the Constitution was very important. That's where Scalia drew a lot of his opinions from. He was an originalist in that sense, not purely an originalist, but he cared about what the intent of the writers of the Constitution said. So looking at that language, is this clearly take action kind of language?
Well, it is, especially when you put into context the fact that the framers of the Constitution were particularly worried about factions and their influence in politics, so parties being an example of factions. And the idea behind the interactions between the president and Congress being less factionally oriented than it is today. So Justice Scalia would look at sort of the original public meanings of how the text would have been understood and how the institutions were supposed to function in light of that text. And so if you do that, it takes away the sort of partisan imperative that each side should try to gain its own advantage through electoral politics that we see going on with the call to delay.
Now, there are those, in especially the conservative side, who said that the American people need to have more of a stake in this, and they'll have that stake by waiting until they choose a next president of the United States, and that's the way to make this process democratic. What do you think Scalia would make of that kind of argument?
First, textually, the people don't choose Supreme Court justices. The president does, with the advice and consent of the Senate. So just on a very superficial way, people don't choose Supreme Court justices. They do it indirectly through the president. But on a second note, the current sitting president is the president until the next inauguration day, and there's nothing in the Constitution that sort of disables a president, you know, for the final year of office. He's the democratically elected president until inauguration day.
If you look at Scalia's record, I mean, let's just say everything you've just said is true. And he was also known as being the most conservative justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. So can we really say with confidence he would have wanted to hold hearings, considering the unique, very high-stakes situation that's ensuing right now?
Yes, maybe. You've got a good point in that question as to anything that we do to speculate what someone would have said in a context. But I think the claim I'm making is that if he were true to his methodological commitments, which are the originalist approach to understanding the Constitution, plus true to the reasons why he was an originalist, and that was to take politics out of Supreme Court decision-making. If you could come up with a more mechanical, more objective methodology for deciding cases, that would remove politics. So we could say that one of his background beliefs about the function of the Supreme Court is that it should be more politically free. And so presumably the nomination of justices should, well, it's, you can't eliminate politics, but should be motivated by concern for the institution in and of itself, not for what you could get out of the institution vis-a-vis some political goal.
We're talking right now with Thomas Crocker, Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law. And he recently wrote an article in The Atlantic called What Would Scalia Do? Looking at the position here, people considering the prospect of considering Merrick Garland, having hearings about whether or not to confirm him. And what do we know about the way that Antonin Scalia thought about the court and the way that he weighted that against the powerful political interests that were hoping that the court would rule a certain direction?
No, he was definitely a very large presence on the court, at least in the public's mind. He was perhaps one of the justices that had more public outreach, more public appearances, a greater public following and knowledge than perhaps many other justices. And so in that sense, he was an ambassador for the court and also a fairly strong presence on the court, often by way of his dissents, which gained a lot of public notoriety as well.
Looking at the Senate's duty in all of this, what they are set to do, is there a case to be made that they're in the Constitution, that they should be waiting on this to give it more consideration?
It's difficult to make that case. I mean, as you've already indicated, the strongest case they have is to say that, well, since we're close enough to an election, we should wait until after that election because the stakes are so momentous for the functioning of the government. But again, the textual case in the Constitution, there's no such guidelines that disables a president from making a nomination. There is, I think the Senate Republicans point to the fact that there has not often been Supreme Court nominations that have been confirmed during election years. And it's hard to say whether that's just a contingent factor of history or a purposeful constitutional practice that has developed. But certainly President Reagan, as recently as the end of his term in the 1980s, nominated and had confirmed sitting Justice Kennedy in the final year of his presidency. So there's fairly recent precedent for doing so.
And not replacing Justice Scalia leaves the court in an easily deadlocked court, a 4-4 split. And, of course, that means that the precedents are going to be set, you know, by the lower courts. Those rulings are going to stand. How do you think that impacts the state of justice in the United States? And what would Scalia think about where we were on that?
It does make the business of the court, one of which is to settle important issues or to settle issues where, for example, in Wisconsin, the Seventh Circuit may decide a case in one way and the Ninth Circuit in California may decide it another way, to decide what should be justice or should be the law for all of us. So when you have 4-4 splits that just uphold the lower courts, you maintain those splits, and so that we have unsettled law for longer. I think Justice Scalia, like any justice, would prefer that the court be able to have its full authority and function in deciding those cases. And so by being one justice short, it does make it more difficult for the court to fulfill its part of our governing institutions.
Was Justice Scalia consistent throughout his tenure on the bench, or was there any evidence that, you know, he might have shifted the way he thought about things, maybe swayed from his originalist look to the Constitution language tendencies and been more interested in responding to the political climate of our time?
Yes, I mean, so Justice Scalia's originalism is a unique methodological commitment that he has. He, Justice Thomas, and Justice Black, the former senator from Alabama, New Deal justice, are the only ones who've ever sort of committed to this methodology. And The methodology is difficult to follow in all cases, and even in cases where it's relevant, because it can be just as difficult to discern what the original public meaning of textual provisions or constitutional practices were as it is to decide how we understand them. There's interpretive ambiguity and room for argument on both sides. So Justice Scalia, one could say, was never fully consistent, but it may just be a function of no one could be consistent to such a methodology. For example, in his Second Amendment case, Heller, which in 2008 was the first time the court had systemically picked up the issue of whether there was a Second Amendment individual right to carry arms, an opinion that's very important to very many Americans as a consequence. Justice Scalia wrote the opinion, but he didn't stick to what the original meaning was. He did, in that opinion, a very, very involved history of how it's been understood in the 19th century and in the 20th century, which is far from what the originalist meaning would be and looks a lot more like living constitutionalism, a view that he often criticized.
Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thomas Crocker is the Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he wrote an article for The Atlantic called What Would Scalia Do? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll look at the relationship between social media and employers and what happens when an employee's personal social media comments become a problem for the employer.
First, it's outdoor farmers market season again in Wisconsin. And if you've been waiting all winter for the growing season, it's already underway. Bill Lubing is here with us to tell us more about what to expect from this year's market season. He's the manager of the Dane County Farmers Market and a member of the Wisconsin Farmers Market Association. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's still early in the season. What's showing up at the market so far this year?
Well, it is early, and the Dane County Farmers Market is one of the first open. First of all, we have some of the spring ramps that are coming. Watercress are the very earliest as far as seasonal vegetables. And then, of course, you've got your ones that are always there as far as the meats, the honey, maple syrup. We'll be having asparagus coming in a few weeks. So we're really just very much at the very beginning of the farmers market season right now.
Now, you're manager of the Dane County Farmers Market. This is one people come to from quite a distance. What kind of things are new this year at the market?
Well, I think a lot of what's new this year is, of course, we won't know until the market gets a little bit further on as far as the actual products, but what people are doing with their products. Farmers are learning that there's much more innovation that can happen as far as, say, for example, the asparagus. You're liable to see it fresh, but you're also liable to see it pickled and maybe made into another sort of a canned product. Many more things happening with tomatoes and other sort of staples that all of a sudden are taking a shelf life rather than fresh. People love the farmers markets. They love coming to the farmers markets. They love cooking with the ingredients, but they also like to have things that are more prepared. You know, they want it fresh, local, and ready to put in the oven and cook. So the vendors have listened to that, and they are developing products that meet that need.
Like what?
Oh, like pizza, for example, that's made with all local ingredients, or soups, or burritos, things that you can take home, put in the oven, and they're ready to go.
Farmers market?
Farmers
market convenience food, it sounds like.
Well, I mean, people are busy, and they appreciate the quality that they're finding at farmers markets, but again, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have that much more time to prepare it themselves. So they're asking for more things that are prepared. And the infrastructure for farmers to create that is improving. I mean, one of the interesting things is there are new things that will be coming to the farmers market, but there are also new things that are evolving around the farmers market. For example, processing kitchens where, you know, a busy farmer can take ingredients in and say, I would like to, you know, take my ingredients and make a pizza, for example, or a soup, and they can have that done and created, and they still have time to do their farming.
Just anecdotally, it seems like the farmers market scene in Wisconsin has gotten a lot bigger. Is that true? Is it growing?
It's growing, absolutely. I mean, we've been around, this is our 44th year, and when we started way back when, there were a few card tables on the Capitol Square, and that was about it in Dane County. Right now, there are 30 farmers markets, you know, right in Dane County, and hundreds more throughout the state.
Talking to Bill Lubing, he's with the Dane County Farmers Market and the Wisconsin Farmers Market Association. Farmers Market season kicking off around the state. And by the way, we want to hear your favorites. What is your favorite local farmers market, and what do you look forward to? What do you go there for? The food, maybe packaged food, pickled food, or is it just the social scene? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Bill, it is about more than just the food. I've got people I consider farmers market friends who I honestly run into, you know, only sure. On farmers market season.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a real bond between many of our vendors, many of our sellers, and the customers. That for many of them, it's a year long bond. They see each other every day because we have winter markets as well. But others, you know, there's a real homecoming at that first. You know, we had our first farmers market last Saturday. I mean, there's so many people that were greeting friends that they hadn't seen all winter. It's a real, there's a real social element to the transaction at not just our farmers market, but farmers markets, you know, in general. People really care about the seller. They care how the seller is doing. They want to buy that person's product. So there's a real personal relationship in the purchasing that is really hard to find in many other venues.
And Bill, speaking of things that we're looking forward to, going back a bit in our conversation, I am dying for morel season to happen. I'm hoping I haven't missed it yet. I don't think I have, but I have managed to do that in the past. What do we know about morels and when we're going to see those at the markets?
Well, morels are going to be a few weeks out, and we will have morels. Generally, they are, well, we'll see what kind of a market we're going to have when we, you know, when it gets there. But things are looking good. So I would keep looking for the morels in the next few weeks. They're going to start up. You know, it's funny because the seasonality of farmers markets really changes. I mean, it means change. Seasonality means from week to week, something new is coming, something is past. Like you say, morels, 3 or 4 weeks at the most, and then that's it. Asparagus, you know, that's coming in a few weeks, and then that'll be here. Ramps are kind of the first fresh product that comes to the market because they're very early. Watercress, same thing. Spinach is, they're actually carrying over the spinach production from the winter. And when it starts getting a little bit warmer, then that's going to die out until fall.
You know, a lot of times at the farmer's market, I imagine a lot of people will look at some of the more off the beaten path produce and vegetables and think, oh, that looks like fun. I don't know what the heck to do with that. Are there ways to get good recipe ideas, food storage ideas for all the stuff we can get at the farmer's market?
Well, at our farmers market and many farmers markets in the state, it's a producer-only market. The person who is selling it is the one who grew it. So there's your source, your primary source right there. But also, I mean, I go to food.com and some of these other online sites when I come across an ingredient that I'm not familiar with or a technique that I'm not familiar with. You know, the internet is a vast resource, talking to other people at the market. So there's a lot of places to get recipes that'll teach you how to cook with the ingredients.
Well, Bill, you're manager of the Dane County Farmers Market, a huge, prestigious, on a national scale market. Are there any secrets that we should know about, things that are rarities beyond the quart and the cheese curd that if you get there at the right time, you're going to get to enjoy?
Well, I mean, as far as ingredients go, you're going to find things that aren't normally, you would normally expect to find in Wisconsin. For example, we've got several people that are growing peanuts, and you would never expect to find Wisconsin-grown peanuts, but we do have that. Some of the ingredients that we have, pesto, for example, was introduced at our farmers market, and many people in the Madison area had no idea what pesto was, but there was a very innovative farmer who grew basil, and he's like, well, I'm going to introduce pesto to this community. We have bitter melon, many of the products that the Hmong bring, which are unusual for us in Wisconsin, but are, you know, gaining an acceptance in our area. So, you know, the best thing and the beautiful thing about a farmer's market is the seller, the grower is right there. You can ask them about it. If it's something you're unfamiliar with, the person that's selling it is going to know about it.
Let's bring in a caller now. We've got Brittany on the line in Madison. Brittany, hi.
Hi. So I was just thinking about my mom always used to take my sister and I to the farmer's market, and every time we would go, we would get the same things. We would get orange chocolate chip scones and basil bread, and I still go, and I get the same two things and other stuff too, but...
Brittany, thanks a lot. And Bill, this market and now some other markets around the state, they've been around long enough that their family traditions handed down through the generations. This is something that we'll be handing down to our kids and maybe their grandkids.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got third generation folks at the farmer's market right now that have been coming for years. They will tell the stories about how when they were kids, they were bundled up and sleeping in the back of the pickup truck while mom and dad got everything set up for the market to open, and how they have changed what their folks did as far as what they were offering and trying to keep up with the times. It's definitely a very earthy sort of a way to make a living, but it's also very moving, progressing sort of a economy.
And we leave it there. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us. That was Bill Lubing, manager of the Dane County Farmers Market.
Coming up, the gray areas of social media, employers, and what employees can say online. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up at 7 tonight, it's a special British edition of The Moth. A record-breaking adventurer sets his sights on the English Channel. A seamstress becomes an advocate for her child, and a young woman is recruited into the world of secret agents during World War II. It's tonight at 7 on The Moth Radio Hour.
First, it's no secret that social media has become an increasingly important part of our daily lives. We use it to share our successes, keep track of friends and family, and engage in discussions about the issues of the day. But what happens when we share our personal views and we share them in a way that might conflict with the views of our employer?
This week, former professional baseball player Curt Schilling was fired from his job as an analyst at ESPN after sharing a photo and commentary on his personal Facebook page that was widely seen as discriminatory against transgender people. While Schilling is a high-profile example of someone getting in hot water with their employer over something said on social media, it's something that employees and employers of all stripes have been dealing with in recent years, and the answers are not always clear.
Steve Knoll joins us now. He's a marketing professor at Madison College. He teaches about social media. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
So let's start with Curt Schilling here. ESPN chose to fire him, but how much choice did they have given his postings?
Well, it's an interesting issue. I mean, he certainly has a history of posting some other politically provocative social media postings. He actually was suspended, I believe it was last year, for a post comparing Muslims to Nazis. So part of this shouldn't really be too much of a surprise that he kind of has a reoccurring theme of, posting provocative stuff. But it does bring about an issue, since he was posting these on his personal Facebook pages. It's kind of the borderline between, if you're a celebrity, where is the fine line between, you as a personality and you as an individual person?
Were you surprised that ESPN did not have a policy that would have been very clear to Curt Schilling when he posted things, so there would not have been any sort of gray area there?
Well, I've been kind of wondering that. It seems like the firing was pretty absolute, and he has been very quiet about it, which does lead me to believe that there was something in writing there. And especially a company the size of ESPN, and of course ESPN is owned by Disney, and Disney is a company that has been very forthright in supporting LGBT issues and non-discriminatory, ideas. So I would wonder if they didn't have some type of dismissal clause built into it. But at the same point, you can argue, where does free speech end when it comes, to posting things that could be contrary to your work policies?
How common is it for companies and employers these days to have a policy regarding employees' social media use?
Well, not common enough, unfortunately. It seems that more and more of these stories are continuing to happen, and you would think that companies would learn about this and realize that having, you know, a social media policy as part of an employee handbook or other piece would be just a normal part of, you know, the HR contracts that with people. But it seems like these stories are not going away, and more companies, I think some companies are kind of concerned with crossing that line between, you know, free speech and then speech of the company. And it is very much a gray area. I mean, we're dealing with new technologies. New technology always moves faster than the law. So part of it, we're in a little bit of, you know, unknown territory here. You know, this is the digital Wild West, and the laws sometimes are being written based on things that have already happened in the past.
Well, according to Vox.com, as you said, the number of firings related to social media is going up. I wonder if people at large are aware that this is a thing now that you can kind of commonly get fired for.
Well, I think the average person would probably realize that. I think the problems that are coming in is when people post, you know, based on an emotional quick action and not really thinking with common sense. In the case of Kurt Schilling, he did pull the posting down. But of course, you know, in the social media world, you really can never delete anything. But it could be something, you know, people sometimes post things, you know, out of frustration, out of anger, out of high emotion, you know, and then they kind of go back and say, oh, I really shouldn't have said that. I can delete it. You know, sometimes that's enough. Other times it's too late. You know, we think about, you know, a day like today where we heard earlier that Prince had passed away, and the outcry on social media and the grief and the shock of his loss. You have to wonder, a lot of them are posting from work, and, you know, if they're posting, you know, he was kind of a controversial figure. What would happen if they're, you know, trying to honor his legacy and posting some of his songs that can be construed as not friendly to your company's brand? Would those people get in trouble simply for expressing their grief?
Hmm. Well, and as you said, people are possibly posting from work if they're posting during the day. Is it something that we're seeing more of, that companies are being very clear about whether or not employees can go on social media at all during the 8-hour workday?
Well, we are, but unfortunately, it's, you know, the workers are looking more and more at companies that have much more open, you know, social media policies. There have been several recent studies looking at millennials and other people, you know, in their 20s, even early 30s, and have proposed the quandary, saying, hey, we've got two job offers. One job pays you $40,000 a year. One pays you $80,000 a year. The job that pays you $80,000 a year, you work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. You don't have any access to social media. Or you could take a job that pays $40,000 and we'll let you have your phone with you, and you can, you know, check Facebook on the company computers and et cetera. And 8 out of 10 of these millennials are choosing the $40,000 a year job because they don't want to give up social media access. You know, for many people, you know, they say that the lifespan of a tweet on Twitter is 20 minutes. And for a lot of people, they don't want to be out of touch for hours at a time. So, and that's, you know, you can argue that, you know, well, is that right or is it wrong? Well, that's a whole different philosophical debate. But the reality is many people don't want to be out of touch for long periods of time. And so they're looking for jobs, and they're looking for, you know, the type of opportunities that give them the freedom to stay in touch as well as do a great job at work.
There's really data about that people are willing to take maybe a $40,000 pay cut just so they can check Facebook and Twitter at work?
Yes. In fact, the number one thing that millennials are looking for and is not a high-paying job. It's a company that has, you know, and I don't want to say necessarily like a liberal social media policy, but they want to have the freedom of being able to stay in contact with their friends and the rest of the world. So if they're saying, well, you got to, you know, check into the office at 9 o'clock, and then, you know, you will do your work until your lunch break, you know, that type of mindset. The old days of the Monday through Friday 9-to-5 work week is really becoming a thing of the past. You know, many people are saying, you know, I'm willing to work nights. I'm willing to check my email for work 7 days a week, even on vacation. But in return for that, I want the ability to be able to check Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and whatever throughout the workday as I'm doing my regular work. So it's a bit of a trade-off. I mean, people are probably putting in more hours than before, but the idea that you are one person from 9 to 5 and then another person after 5 p.m., that type of person is fading into the past.
We're talking right now with Steve Knoll of Madison College, talking about social media and employers, looking at how baseball analyst Curt Schilling from ESPN was fired over comments he made on his personal Facebook page, checking out this wider issue of social media and the workplace now. And so in terms of what can and cannot get you into hot water, Steve, are there particular things that we need to agree upon, or at least it makes sense to be aware of when you're posting?
Well, a big question, and this is really kind of an obvious one, is are you posting on your own personal accounts or are you posting on company accounts? You know, that right away, there should be a clear differentiation. You know, a lot of these social media oopses that happen are a result of, you know, people either using a phone or a computer software program, and they're kind of, you know, going back and forth between their own Twitter page and the company's Twitter page. And then they go to say something thinking it's their own, and they accidentally post on their company's page instead. You know, that seems to be something that should not be happening. That's a pretty obvious, you know, how the heck is that happening like that? But more and more companies should be thinking about that. I mean, you know, in the old days, I hate to compare it to a smoke break, but it seems like a lot of companies should think about that. It's, you know, if you, in the past, if you had, you know, a smoke break every 2 hours, do you have to offer employees a Facebook break, or should you offer a Facebook break? Would that make your company more attractive in terms of hiring people? You know, right now with the job situation isn't great out there, but a lot of companies are now finding that they have, in order to get good employees, you have to basically recruit them from other businesses. You know, the people that don't have jobs, you know, may not be the people that you want working for it. So you've got to offer something that your competitors aren't offering. And maybe, you know, a more open social media policy could be something that is more attractive than extra vacation days or $2 more an hour.
Well, and then on the other hand, I've heard of employers, when they're interviewing people to come work at their company, asking them to hand over the passwords to their accounts so that they can check out what kind of person they are before they hire them.
Oh, yeah, that's been a huge fiasco. I mean, the whole ramifications as to whether or not that's legal or not, that's still being debated, and probably I wouldn't be surprised if a story like that makes it all the way up to the Supreme Court, just because, you know, the ramifications there, it's, if you think of the idea of, say that you offered me a job, and part of the condition of me accepting the job is you get the keys to my house, and you can come walk into my house and go through everything in my bedroom before you hire me the job. I mean, that's kind of a similar analogy to saying you have to give us your Facebook passwords and all that. So there is kind of a line there as to, you know, is this legal or ethical? You know, part of it is I think employers asking someone for their Facebook passwords is not illegal, but certainly it would be unethical. But it also then, you know, that person does have the right to say, thank you for the job offer, but I do not want to work for a company that would do that. So, you know, those issues are still out there, and a few companies have gotten in some hot water over it. But certainly, I do not think that asking for passwords is going to become a regular part of the job interview.
Steve Knoll is with us now from Madison College, talking about social media and employers. What happens when an employee's personal social media comments become a problem for the employer? Talking about this after ESPN fired analyst Curt Schilling over comments he made about transgender people on his personal Facebook page.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten in hot water with your employer over a comment on social media? Tell us what happened. Should employers be able to fire employees based on comments made on a personal social media page? Should employers be able to get the keys to employees' social media accounts? And what's the line between appropriate and inappropriate behavior by an employee that might reflect poorly or well on their employer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with social media expert Steve Knoll from Madison College, looking at what happens when an employee's personal social media comments become a problem for their employer. This week, ESPN fired analyst Kurt Schilling over comments he made about transgender people on his personal Facebook page. That's one high-profile example, but it's something we've seen playing out more and more in recent years.
And you can join in with your comments at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gotten in trouble with your employer over a social media comment? And if so, what happened? And what do you think employers should do, if anything, when their employees go too far on their social media pages? And what do you think constitutes going too far? How should we learn about what that is? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Steve, going back to Kurt Schilling, are there different rules at play there? Because this is a guy who's playing in the big leagues, not metaphorically, well, I guess metaphorically too, in the media. He's on ESPN, a major media company. Are there different standards there that need to be at play for journalists and analysts like Schilling?
Well, and I think using the word journalist is an interesting way of saying that, because is he a journalist or is he more kind of a celebrity? And I think that anyone that's in these high-profile, you know, certainly high-dollar amount jobs, you would expect that part of that is going to come with some strings. They talk about anytime with celebrities, they talk about morality clauses in contracts. And that can mean a lot of different things. But I certainly think that anyone that has high profile, high visibility, and high earning jobs should probably be, you know, held to a higher standard. And certainly everybody has the rights to their own personal opinions and all that. But, you know, certainly I don't think we really should feel bad for him. You know, this is something that he should have known better. A lot of people that when they get in trouble like this, they should have known better. And given that he has a history of posting stuff like this in the past, I think ESPN and Disney finally just said, you know, enough is enough. It's not worth it. You become more of a liability. And I think that's where the line goes as to how severe the comment is. If we're talking about somebody working in a small shop and they say something, what's the liability issue there?
Or what about someone at the New York Times? What should they have to adhere to?
Well, you know, there's a lot of clear-cut boundaries with journalism. I mean, there's a lot of integrity that's to be expected, and journalists at least are expected to be at least relatively neutral in terms of not injecting themselves into their story. You know, of course, it's possible for a journalist themselves to become part of the story, but I think that's something that journalists strive not to do. They're there to, you know, report the story as objectively as possible. You know, in the case of Kurt Schilling, he was passing on what he thought was, you know, a funny, humorous joke, which in seeing it, it's fairly mean-spirited, but he didn't come up with it, but he should have known not to pass on something like that. So it's a big difference between somebody like that's really more of a borderline commentator/celebrity figure, and then somebody, you know, working for the New York Times who's an investigative journalist.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Daniel on the line in Eau Claire. Daniel, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's kind of a touchy subject. As someone who was born in the 90s and has social media and has the text messaging abilities, I think it's kind of something that needs to get investigated further when it comes to, like, studying and how it affects workplace and whatnot. But obviously, I think it should come with tact when it comes to viewing social media while you're at work. Or employers maybe need to open up a little bit. And I like the idea of having possible breaks for those things, because you can't really get away from social media these days now that it's 2016.
Daniel, thanks a lot for that. And what do you think about that? We're evolving with social media. Workplaces need to evolve, Steve.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, the reality is that social media is not just a fad. It's not going anywhere. It's a fundamental shift in communications. And society is never going to go away from that. And I think it's up to businesses to evolve with the times and accept that that's how it is. That's how people want to communicate. And if companies don't do that, they're going to be left behind. And there's a lot of, especially in the upper level management, people that didn't grow up with social media, you know, it's a very, very different idea from every generation. And every generation is different. I mean, it goes back to, you know, our grandparents saying that, you know, Elvis Presley and rock and roll was the end of Western civilization as we know it. And, of course, now we look at that and think how quaint it is. Well, our caller we just had, he said he was born in the 90s. By the time he's a grandparent, you know, what will his grandkids, how will they communicating? Will it be holographic? Will it be telepathic? And will he look at it and go, oh, I just wish people would go back to Twitter like a normal person?
Daniel, thanks for that. Let's go to Scott in Milwaukee. Scott, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Glad to hear it. So I used a pseudo, I am on social networking, but I used a pseudonym. And an employer asked me, are you on Facebook or any social media? And I said, yes. And then I believe I was disqualified because they couldn't find me on social media or social networking because I used a pseudonym.
Right.
And I was just curious to know what your guest had to say about that.
Scott, thanks for that. And he's not alone, as you see. A lot of people now circumvent this whole worry by just having a sort of a fake name for their Facebook account, presumably one that doesn't look fake because Facebook doesn't like that anymore. Mm-hmm. But what about doing that?
Well, technically, that is a violation of Facebook terms. That's part of what Facebook originally was built on, was the idea of representing, you know, truly who you are. And that's become a very touchy subject because a lot of people have been, you know, altering their Facebook pages or creating pages without their actual given names. And that in itself is a whole other phone conversation. Technically, yes, Facebook could boot you off the service for violating their terms. But however, I've never heard of a company rescinding a job offer for not being able to find you. That would be something that an HR person would have to, you know, look into that. I do know it's very, very common that, you know, HR people, when they're investigating candidates, will look on the social media to see if they can, you know, just because you're on Facebook doesn't mean that, and somebody's not a friend of you, doesn't mean they can't actually see at least some of the stuff on your page. So that is one thing to think about. And it's not just Facebook, it's Twitter and Instagram and a lot of these other more casual social medias that people are posting a lot more personal and potentially, you know, provocative and, you know, job eliminating.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us. Steve Noel, a professor of marketing at Madison College, talking about social media and employers.
I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.